Information. False claims about climate change are rampant on social media. Dr. Anthony Leizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Decades ago, public service announcements asked parents, "It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?" But a recent campaign to fight online misinformation about climate change turned that script on its head by asking young people, "It's 10 p.m. Do you know what your parents are scrolling?"
A lot of the reasons why we try to instill comedy and humor into our videos is because people are more likely to engage and more likely to learn and laugh at the same time.
Javi Garcia is with the Gas Leaks Project, which teaches people about the harms of fossil fuels. The group partnered with the nonprofit Green Latinos to produce videos and social media posts in English and Spanish, encouraging people to help their parents recognize false and misleading content. He says Latinos are particularly exposed to climate misinformation, in part because they often get their news from social media, where false claims are rampant. Yet at the same time, many live in areas with a high risk of climate disasters.
I'm from Puerto Rico, and we see the effects of climate change happening firsthand. You know, beaches that are being swallowed by the water, more intense hurricanes.
So he says it's especially important to counter climate misinformation in Latino communities. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and James Kemp. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and Farah Siddiqui. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. Why did the U.S. end up bombing Iran? U.S. and Israeli leaders said it was because Iran was about to build a nuclear weapon. But many analysts, including those in the U.S. intelligence community, don't believe that to be true. Nader Hashemi is an associate professor of the Middle East and Islamic politics and the director of the Al-Walid Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about what was behind the attack on Iran.
Why now? Why would the U.S. choose to pick this moment to bomb Iran? Was it just a matter of political opportunity, or was it just that Netanyahu managed to convince Trump that now was the right time? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think both of those things. I think fundamentally, the U.S.-Israeli bombing of Iran at this moment was a byproduct of political opportunity. In other words, Iran right now is incredibly weak as a state, as a country, as a political system. It's lost most of its regional allies, Hezbollah, particularly Hamas, and it's a country
that has it lost them, or are they just a little decimated right now.
Well, they're decimated. You know, I think they're not going to recover anytime soon. I mean, what Israel is doing in Gaza has really broken the back of Hamas, but I don't think they're down and out forever. But their ability to sort of, you know, project Iranian power has been limited. I think this whole discussion and the framing in the United States that Hamas is a proxy of Iran sort of completely distorts what's actually going on with Hamas. It's more of an Israel-Palestine phenomenon. It's not like Iran has created Hamas and, you know, pulls the strings.
But or any more than the Houthis, yeah.
Any more than the Houthis, exactly. You know, they're responding to particular local contexts. But I think Hezbollah is the big story here in terms of Iran's weakening regional power, because in Iran's national security doctrine, support for Hezbollah was very much predicated on using them in a crisis moment such as the one that we just witnessed, that if ever there was an American or Israeli attack, Iran hoped that Hezbollah could come to its rescue by opening up a second front. That's no longer an option because of what happened last summer. So they're not out of the picture, but they're severely weakened. And so economically, Iran is, you know, a very weak country. It's been under heavy sanction really for the last 45 years, but increasingly since Trump came to power in the first term of his presidency, and he tore up the Iran nuclear agreement and imposed very heavy sanctions. It's a weak country economically. It has a young population that aspires for more freedoms and a repressive regime that rules over them. And so I think emboldened by what Israel and the United States were able to pull off in other theaters in the Middle East, there was a sense that, look, we need to press ahead. And as Netanyahu said in the New York Times, rewrite the map of the Middle East.
Kind of like Bush Cheney wanted to do with...
Exactly. Very similar to that. Yeah. Very similar to that. In fact, after Hezbollah was crushed, I was in Washington D.C. at the time and I was following the debate. There was huge enthusiasm across the political spectrum that this is a wonderful thing for the United States in particular. And Israel is proving its worth as a reliable sort of ally in the region, because it's doing things that we want to do but we can't do for domestic reasons, for economic reasons.
So kind of ignoring the whole humanitarian crisis and the civilian deaths.
Completely, exactly, as if that's a price that's worth paying. Who cares about, you know, okay, 50,000, 100,000 Palestinians die. That doesn't really impact our geostrategic thinking of the Middle East. Israel is, you know, and there was actually comparisons to the famous Sykes-Picot arrangement that shaped the modern state of the Middle East, that was happening right now. And Israel was basically redrawing the political map. And at the time, that was last summer, now that these, you know, Iranian allies were defeated, we need to press ahead and go after Tehran. And so I think what happened, if you follow the debate, Trump was committed to negotiation. But when negotiations started to, you know, predictably hit difficulty, instead of doubling down on negotiations and compromising, Netanyahu was able to convince Trump that let us hit Iran and we can soften them up a bit, and that will help you at the negotiating table down the road. But I think fundamentally, from a strategic perspective, from a military perspective, the view was that Iran sort of plays a unique role in the region as an obstacle to American and Israeli policy. And if we can get rid of that government, or at least severely weaken it, this would be a net gain for American interest, Israeli interest, the interest of Arab dictators, all of who are aligned, you know, in this, you know, arrangement known as the Abraham Accords. And it would be a net gain for, you know, Western and Israeli interests. And so, you know, that's fundamentally, I think, what the calculus was. And I have to say, in the short term, that has been accomplished, because, you know, if we just saw, if Iran was so weak, it couldn't protect its most senior military officials, its nuclear scientists. It didn't even have control over its own air force, which also challenges the narrative that we've been exposed to, that Iran was this hegemonic power taking over the Middle East. You know, if it was so hegemonic and so powerful, how did it sort of collapse relatively quickly?
Although they do have the power to strike back.
They have the power to strike back, but increasingly, you know, that's all they really had. And Israel was hitting those, you know, military, the missile launchers quite effectively. So yeah, it hasn't been completely down and hasn't been completely sort of shattered or broken yet. So I think that's fundamentally the calculation that, in terms of the why now question. And in the piece that I wrote in The Guardian, I sort of draw an analogy to, you know, the Cold War in Latin America, where for those of us who are old enough, we recall that everything in Latin America in terms of its security situation back then during the Cold War, particularly during the Reagan era, was blamed on, you know, Cuba and then Nicaragua, as if they were the countries
that were responsible.
Or the
Soviet Union, for that matter.
And then the Soviet Union orchestrating everything, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, it was the Soviet Union, and then it was those countries. But of course, that was always a gross exaggeration. It was an easy way of sort of explaining the politics of the of that region. And the reason why, you know, Cuba was blamed, because Cuba was, you know, challenging American interests in the region in the same way that Iran is challenging, you know, Western interests in the Middle East.
And what about the calculation that some are making that the population will rebel against the regime even as the country is being bombed? What do you make of that?
I think it's complete fantasy. It reflects, I think, a complete misunderstanding of internal Iranian politics and even understanding of how political change takes place. I don't know of any case where you change a regime by bombing it from the air. I think what's actually going to happen is the exact reverse of these aspirations for regime change. The regime is actually going to get strengthened because it's going to play the nationalism flag. It's going to invoke powerful themes that are foundational to the identities of not just Iranians and people in the Middle East, but throughout the global South. The identities of these people in the global South were deeply shaped by the struggle for independence and decolonization. I mean, I could go through the whole history here, but in the case of Iran, Iran was severely affected. Its political development was severely affected by Western intervention, most prominently in 1953 when the United Kingdom and the United States, you know, intervened to topple Iran's best chance for democracy. And so that's a theme that's going to be invoked and exploited by the regime. And the other, I think, you know, element here is that, you know, the people who are calling for regime change in this moment are deeply unsavory and unscrupulous characters. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu and, you know, Donald Trump, you know, are not known for their moral virtue and commitment to human rights and democracy. So it's very difficult to sort of sign on to that project, given the people who are promoting this, you know, idea. So I think when you put it all together, it's actually going to set back the internal struggle for democracy in Iran. And that's just not my personal opinion. Listen to all those heroic Iranian dissidents and activists who are in Iran, who've been in and out of jail. They're saying the exact same things that I'm saying, that this war is actually going to be a net setback for their struggle. The regime is going to now crack down, I think, very heavily on civil society, using the excuse of a national security crisis in the name of going after Mossad agents to, you know, round up and kill anyone, because we do know that Mossad agents heavily penetrated Iran. So I think we're going to see very soon a dark period of further repression within the Islamic Republic of Iran. And a big reason for that is these recent attacks.
Aren't there governments in that area looking at this situation, the U.S. coming in very heavy with Israel and thinking, you know, they could do that to us if they want? And then, you know, then there's the whole Turkish angle. They must not be too happy about U.S. power in the Middle East to that extent.
No, I think the lesson from these countries, particularly if they're countries that have an independent foreign policy or they're not under they're not within the U.S.-Israeli orbit. My advice to Turkey right now, of course, I'm not a fan of the government there because it's authoritarian, but you better get a nuclear weapon, because if Israel is successful against Iran and crushes it, Turkey is next. And in fact, if you listen to the debate within Israel, there's actually talk of this, that Turkey will then be the next sort of regional obstacle to Israel's desire to be the hegemon.
Even though it's a NATO member.
Even though it's a NATO member, right? It's a NATO member. I mean, that poses problems, obviously, for Israel. But I think the net takeaway for many countries around the world is that if you have a nuclear weapon like North Korea does, you're protected. If you don't, like Iran, you can be invaded and bombed. And I think that also has, and I predict we'll see this very soon, the only natural logical step for the Iranian regime is to pull out of the non-proliferation treaty and try and get a nuclear weapon as quickly as possible because of what just happened. And in fact, if you follow the internal Iranian debate, as I had, when Obama sought to pursue a diplomatic path with Iran, hardliners in Iran were saying, look, we can't trust the United States. Let's just stand firm. Let's not compromise our nuclear program. Let's develop, you know, a nuclear capability, because we might need it. We can't risk the security of our country. There was an internal debate. The pragmatists, the reformists won out. There was a nuclear deal that was struck. Iran was adhering to it. And it was precisely Donald Trump, at the encouragement of Netanyahu, who tore up that agreement. And internally within Iran, the consequence of that event in 2018 was that the hardliners pointed to the pragmatists, to the reformists, and said, see what you've done to us. You compromised our nuclear program, which was advanced. We have no protection now. We're under heavy sanction. And as a result of what's happened over the last 12 days, anyone in Iran who tries to sort of say we need to have diplomacy with the United States will be laughed at. you know, because ironically, you know, the United States and Iran were in the middle of diplomatic negotiations when Israel bombed and the United States gave the green light. So there's going to be no appetite for diplomacy anymore. There's going to be a strong appetite within the regime and within society for becoming a nuclear weapons state, because that's going to be the only way you can protect yourself. And people are going to point to North Korea as evidence, and Pakistan and other countries. And so ironically, the claim that, you know, the United States and Israel have weakened or taken out Iran's nuclear program will have the exact opposite effect.
And then there's the astounding fact that nobody in the Western media pays much attention to the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons.
That's a great point. And you know, there's been discussion of a nuclear weapons free zone in the Middle East for a very long time. Iran has strongly supported it. Israel has not. And the reason for that is because in the international system, you know, if you're on the home team, there's double standards that apply to you. To put it in another way, the West doesn't have a problem with nuclear weapons in the Middle East. They have a problem with nuclear weapons being in the hands of their adversaries, not their friends. And that's just a fundamental principle. The other related point is that the argument is that, look, we can't trust this, you know, brutal regime in Iran with nuclear weapons because look at their human rights record. Well, let's apply that same principle to Israel and its human rights record as an apartheid state.
Well, they have to defend themselves against terrorism.
So, I mean, those arguments no longer hold anymore. So I think this is a, you know, I think that I actually think this is a defining moment for the region. I think things are going to get much uglier rather than better. And so I'm very worried about, you know, what comes next.
But you don't think it'll end up as what you might call the Christian Zionist wet dream, where the apocalypse happens and they're waiting for the second coming, that kind of thing?
Obviously, some people in the MAGA coalition actually, you know, are motivated by that particular narrative. I don't think Trump is, because you know, he's fundamentally secular, but he plays that card to get their support. But I think there's certainly, you know, that type of messianic sort of cult of thinking in the MAGA coalition and within Netanyahu's coalition in a different way, though, that sort of are driving these political decisions. So it's a dark moment.
That's Georgetown University Associate Professor Nader Hashemi speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. I have here with me Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, Laura Grimes, to discuss a few recent articles. So, hi, thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me, Hannah.
Of course. So first, let's talk about this article, A Little Retro and Thoroughly Modern, Chamber Music Northwest 2025 Pairs Baroque and Contemporary Composers. This year's festival, Echoes of Bach, features a bevy of familiar performers and composers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will mention that Chamber Music Northwest celebrates its 55th season this year. And this Chamber Music Northwest is a venerable institution in Portland. It has longtime enthusiasts that go every year. That has sort of its own customs in some ways. It has a real like fan base. They have concerts all year, but they in a variety of programming. But the big festival happens during the summer. This year's festival, like you mentioned, it's called Echoes of Bach. It runs through July 27th, and the festival will have concerts, workshops, classes, celebrations, and they'll be staged all over Portland and the outlying areas. Like a lot of them are at Reed's Cull Auditorium, but they'll also be at Lincoln Hall at Portland State University, the Old Church in downtown Portland, Patricia Reeser Center for the Arts in Beaverton. And some concerts will be performed both in Portland and in Eugene at the Oregon Bach Festival, which is some smart collaborative cross-programming there. And there'll also be some free community concerts in Newburgh, Vancouver, Washington, and North Clackamas Park. So you asked who else will be featured. There'll be Bach, but there'll also be Felix Mendelssohn, Messiaen, Brahms, Dvorak, Mozart, Rossini. So a whole variety of composers, a variety of types of concerts. There'll be some no-cost live music, like open rehearsals, workshops, master classes, Young Artist Institute concerts, all types of events that will happen all over. And again, that's Chamber Music Northwest concerts happening all around town through July 27th.
Amazing. Sounds like a lot of fun.
A lot going on there. They were founded in like the early 70s. So people have just kind of longtime fun memories of going to concerts long ago and hanging out on the lawn at Reed College and having picnics. And there's just kind of a lot of people have nostalgia about going to Chamber Music Northwest concerts. So it's nice to see that it's still vibrant and going strong.
Absolutely. Next, let's discuss Neskowin, A Book of Found Photos. Artist Michael Schlichting's quest to uncover the history of his Hawk Creek Gallery building leads to book. The book, due out this summer from the Neskowin Historical Foundation, captures 100 years of life in the small Oregon coast town. Will you tell me a little bit more about this?
This is such a fun story by Lori Tobias. It's really had a lot of views, and the photos are really charming that you can see on our site at Oregon Arts Watch, orartswatch.org. It's just a small sampling of these photos, so I'm really curious when this book comes out. The story recounts this kind of whole fun history of the project. If you're not familiar with Neskowin, it's a picturesque little town with sweet little cottages. It's just north of Lincoln City and just up the coast from it a little bit. Neskowin has a population of around 300 people. There's a little creek that runs through it that's fun to play in, and there's this iconic jutting rock that's on the beach. It's called Proposal Rock. During low tide, you can access it and climb up it. It's really steep and kind of treacherous, but, you know, young, active folks do it. The beaches are always really fun. It's a sweet little town. So Michael Schlichting, the artist, grew up there, and he has lived in this former two-room Neskowin schoolhouse for all these years, and his grandparents actually owned it before him. So soon after he moved in into this two-room schoolhouse, this historic schoolhouse, Michael Schlichting began searching for historic photos of it. He was kind of curious about the context and just kind of the history of it, but all he could usually find were typical class photo shots, all these years. So about 3 years ago, he made a plea on Facebook for old photos of the schoolhouse, and they started to come in. In particular, another resident of Neskowin, Jim Affolter, whose family had settled into the town in the 1870s, he had several photo albums that his family had created. His father had been a bit of a photography buff, and he had taken photos in Neskowin from the late 30s and 40s of people playing in the ocean and kids playing football on the beach. And there were also photos that dated back to the 1880s, ancestors clearing valleys to create their farms, and photos of crude cabins and barn structures. So 3 years ago, about when these all came in, the Neskowin Historical Foundation formed, and that group continued Schlichting's request for more historical photos. They reached out to friends and historical societies and social media, and all of these photos and more history poured in, and it's developed into this big project where they're going to bring out this 320-page coffee table book that spans 100 years of Neskowin, historic photos of Neskowin. So this is all what grew out of Schlichting's search that he started some decades ago. So I'm excited to see this book. It's attracted, our story, like I mentioned, has attracted a lot of attention. And it's just a sort of sweet, small community effort to bring together this history of this picturesque little town. So it'll be fun to see when that comes out.
Absolutely. Thanks. Suzanne Nance, the CEO of All Classical Radio, is leaving for a job in Ireland. And this is kind of a huge deal, right? Because Suzanne has been at All Classical Radio for, I believe, like 10 years, right?
Years, yeah. She kind of came in. She didn't know Portland. Portland didn't know Suzanne, and she quickly made an enormous impact. Her legacy will live on for years. It was kind of interesting. Just before I heard that she was leaving, I'd actually been thinking about her, how lucky Portland has been to have her. She's been such a visionary leader. She helped to, when she first got here, she helped to secure a radio tower for them because their signal was lapsing. And that was a whole logistical piece that she had to navigate. And she's built that team there. They've done some major projects. She sort of moved that whole radio station kind of into the contemporary classical music sphere. They've developed a whole canon of new compositional works by people. It really, she's just been a powerhouse there. And so there's an announcement that is just made this morning, what she's going to do. She's moving to Ireland, and she's going to become the executive director of the Wexford Festival Opera. We actually don't even have our, which is a plum job for her. It's perfect. Her husband's from Ireland, so I'm sure it's going to be a lovely move for her, but we will definitely miss her. I personally will miss her. We'll have a wonderful story by Brett Campbell coming soon. This is all in the works right now. We've been waiting to time it until that information was embargoed until this morning because Wexford wanted to make their announcement. But Brett Campbell really knows the station in and out. He knows the classical music terrain. He is very familiar with Suzanne's incredible legacy that she's built there. So he will have a terrific story that has the whole context coming soon on our site at Oregon Arts Watch or artswatch.org.
You also mentioned that five arts-related bills were in play during the Oregon legislative session, two of which passed. Can you tell me a little bit more about these bills?
Yeah, there actually might be. I kind of dug into a little bit more, and I'm still waiting for our story to pop in. So, hopefully we'll have more information about this on our site soon. But what I have been able to cobble together so far, and I'll just kind of do a recap of all of the arts funding. So there will be full funding for 13 projects that were recommended all over the state, like brick and mortar kind of projects that the Cultural Resources Economic Fund had recommended. It's called CREF. So it's a total of $8.275 million that will go to build, restore, and preserved community spaces across the state. They're being Coos Bay, Bend, Jacksonville, Salem. So they were all projects that had went through a peer review project and were selected. So that's nice that all 13 of those projects were able to be funded, especially this year where funds have been, short for the state, and they've been really sort of fiercely debated. One other piece is that the Oregon Arts Commission is their funding for the commission is going to hold steady. It was recommended that it be increased, and they didn't get that increase in funding. But they also did not get a decrease in funding, which is remarkable in itself. But to give it some context, the Arts Commission's budget has stayed the same for 17 years. So, if you consider inflation and their buying power and their budget has lowered considerably, it really affects them. It really has an impact on them. So, they aren't going to decrease their funding, but really their buying power is smaller. So that is one of the things that did not pass, but it also it also did not, their budget did not get lowered. So that's good. Another piece that was reauthorized, the historic preservation incentives reauthorized. It's the Oregon Special Assessment for Historic Properties Program. It's a vital tax credit for those had expired, so it needed to be reauthorized. And the program encourages investment in historic buildings by providing a discounted tax assessment for 10 years in exchange for appropriate preservation improvements. So that worked. And then lawmakers did not fund a proposal for six large arts organizations around the state, but they did make an investment in the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and Portland Center Stage. So even though not everything made it, a couple things did. One bill that did not make it, which is a little bit baffling to some of us just sort of kind of keeping track of this. I'm not sure what the inside information is on this. I'm curious to know, but there was a bill to merge the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust, and it never got to a vote. So it's not going to be able to happen for 2 years now. There had been a proposal to merge the two agencies and make it a new semi-independent agency. It, which sounds like kind of basic housekeeping. There were actually no finances related to this at all. So you would think that this would have been a typical sort of housekeeping move, that everybody would be in favor of having more efficient government. and so there was no controversy about it. So I'm not really sure why it didn't go through, unless there were some logistical amendments that maybe didn't happen soon enough, or maybe it lost its way, or, you know, kind of flew under everybody's radar. And the reason I mentioned this particular bill is that if the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust, a lot of people don't even realize that they are